Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, May 17, 2019. Community effort for the common good. This is the 33rd program for our 2018-2019 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson, and I am the president of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club if you like, and we would like you to do that by visiting our website at cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, which follow. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. For more, visit www.kp.org. The University of Oregon, support comes from the university, which has been in our community since 1876 and has helped many Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information can be found at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health is our local medical institution in Eugene and in Springfield. Next. They have been with us for 125 years, and their mission is shaped by the purpose of to promote personal and community wellness, to relieve pain and suffering, and to treat each person in a loving, caring way. For more information, please visit peacehealth.org. And our SAFAR sponsor today is Johnson & Johnson, Lucas & Middleton. Support comes from the law offices of Johnson & Johnson, Lucas & Middleton, whose mission it is to obtain justice and fair compensation for people who have been harmed because of someone's wrongful conduct. For more information, contact justicelawyers.com. Now, about our speaker. Today, we're going to be hearing from Max Williams, who serves as the CEO of Oregon Community Foundation. The Oregon Community Foundation has put money to work for Oregon. As a philanthropic organization, it has awarded more than $100 million in grants and scholarships through the years, and annually, over $100 million in grants and scholarships. And from those grants and scholarships, over 2,000 charitable organizations have benefited. OCF has existed for 45 years, grant making, supporting research, advocacy, community advised solutions, and has helped individuals, families, businesses, and organizations create charitable funds to improve the lives of all Oregonians. OCF believes the future of Oregon's children is dependent on the well-being of families and communities. So please join me today in welcoming Max Williams, who will tell you much more about the OCF. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. It's really a pleasure for me to be here and to be with all of you, and thank you for the invitation to come and speak to the Eugene City Club. I also just want to comment on the, for those of you who are hearing this on the recording, you missed a wonderful performance by the youth orchestra members that were playing that string quartet before we started, and it's just such a pleasure to see young people who are engaged in that kind of wonderful demonstration of art. So something we care very much about at the Oregon Community Foundation. I thought I might just give you a brief little background about myself, and then we'll talk a little bit more about OCF and why we do the work we do. I was born and raised in Central Oregon. I grew up in Bend and have spent my whole life as an Oregonian. My original career was in the practice of law, and I practiced law for a number of years, and then had a time serving in the Oregon legislature. And I served in the Oregon legislature for three terms, and then was invited by then Governor Kulongoski to become the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. An invitation that I initially refused, but then with some persuasion ultimately agreed to do. So I spent 8 years running the state's prison system, and I did that up until the time that I became the president and CEO of the Oregon Community Foundation. And you can imagine the surprise of so many people that the board of directors of the state's largest philanthropy would ask the head of the state's prison system to come on and be its new president. I get asked, quite frankly, fairly often the question, how did that happen? How did that transition take place? And some people who know me well enough will ask, and what did the staff think when they heard that you were going to be the new president of OCF? The staff are pretty careful about telling me what they initially thought for all the obvious reasons. Actually, the connection is really rather simple for me. Having spent my whole life in Oregon and working on behalf of and for Oregonians and things that I care about in what I believe is this great state that we live in, I, with my 8 years at the Department of Corrections, I had the opportunity to see a side of Oregon that I wasn't particularly proud of and one that concerned me very gravely. Most of the people who end up in our prison systems today have had incredibly challenging life experiences in their own right. The vast majority of them have been victims before they ever became a perpetrator and got themselves in the situation they were in. That's not to excuse anybody from the personal responsibility of the decisions they make, but I often say that I had 8 years of running the Department of Failure. And what I mean by that was that I got to see where all the other systems that we have at play failed these people, whether it was their families, whether it was their community, whether it was the education system, the foster care system, or the juvenile justice system. I saw where those failures happened and the difficulty that we have in serving this particular population. So my opportunity to go to the Oregon Community Foundation as its president and CEO was an opportunity to go someplace where we were actually addressing the problems in a much more upstream sort of way. Because what I can promise you about the challenges of working with that population is it's very difficult to bend that curve at the back end after people have gone through those experiences. And what we know about the research in brain science and everything else that we've learned over the last 30 years on this issue is early intervention with kids and families is exactly where we need to be to make the difference for this to happen. So with that in mind, I was really attracted to the opportunity at the Oregon Community Foundation because of its commitment to that level of investment. So with that little part of my history, I want to tell you a little bit more about who the Oregon Community Foundation is and what we do. The Oregon Community Foundation was founded, as you heard, 45 years ago. By a group of very generous and committed Oregonians who really believed that if they came together around this idea of charitable giving and philanthropy, others would follow. What was unique about OCF at the time that it was founded is it was one of very few, still very few, community foundations that are actually statewide, that serve an entire state. Often they're very community-based, and they saw OCF as an opportunity to create a statewide approach to philanthropy with the idea that it would bind and bound together those organizations and people who see the opportunity for philanthropy to connect an otherwise somewhat divided and diversified state. So that initial gift to OCF to get it off the ground was a $63,000 fund that was established. Interestingly enough, with our pre-event music this morning, it was an arts-related fund to support arts-related funding. So 45 years ago, that was $63,000. Today, through the incredible generosity of Oregonians all over the state, the assets of the Oregon Community Foundation are now about $2.3 billion, making us one of the largest community foundations in the country, which I think is an incredibly impressive testament to the generosity and community spirit of Oregonians who have seen philanthropy as a means of impacting and changing their community. The mission of the Oregon Community Foundation is to improve the lives of all Oregonians through the power of philanthropy. And we really put the emphasis on all Oregonians. And as a statewide organization, We are in almost every, well, I would say in every community and hamlet across the state. We have staff in five separate offices around Oregon, but we also have this incredible network of volunteers, which I'll share with you in just a moment. We help Oregonians and communities thrive with the tools and resources that we have that include things like grants and scholarships and loans, our research work that we do through our very robust research department and the publication of that research in an effort to address policy and advocacy related work that we do at the foundation. You heard mentioned that typically annually we're making grants and scholarships of more than $100 million a year to thousands of nonprofit organizations all over the state. And again, those grants come both from OCF proper, meaning the discretionary money that OCF's board has, but also from our incredibly generous donors who are using the funds that they've created at the Oregon Community Foundation to grant to organizations and to projects and to issues that they feel strongly about and support. Just in the last year at OCF, we adopted a new strategic plan. And we're approaching and thinking about our 50th anniversary as we hit 45 with a plan to really think about how we're going to celebrate community philanthropy at 50 years. And we really believe the way to do that is to deliver greater philanthropic investment throughout the state by inspiring impactful giving, engaging and supporting communities, and advancing opportunities for all Oregonians. So it's not an easy task, but we work with these donors in this incredible network, and that's what I wanted to spend a minute talking about. It sounds like a fair amount of money, $2.3 billion and $100 million a year going out in charitable and philanthropic grants, but compared to both the level of the challenges that we face in this state, and certainly having been a former state agency head, I can tell you compared to state budgets, it's not very much money. It's not really the size of money that makes OCF powerful. It's the things that that money can do, the kinds of investments, opportunities to test and innovate in certain areas, and to pay for services, resources, and research and other things that normal government organizations simply can't do from their budget that makes that money special. But what really is the power behind the Oregon Community Foundation is this powerful network that we have been able to create over the last 45 years. This network includes more than 1,700 volunteers around the state who work with us. These volunteers serve in responsibilities that include from everything from on our board and board committees that we do to serving on scholarship committees all over the state. To serving on our eight leadership councils. We have the state kind of broken into eight regions. These leadership councils are made up of people from all of those small towns and regions of the state, and they are our eyes and ears and connecting us to community, and really, for me, putting the community, which is our middle name, into the Oregon Community Foundation. So we use these incredible network of volunteers to stay active and connected in communities around the state. We use volunteers to help us do grant evaluation. As we look at grant requests, these volunteers help us think about whether or not these are the appropriate grants. They visit with nonprofits and they do this incredible work. Also part of our network are the other philanthropic organizations around the state who we partner with, whether it's the Ford Family Foundation or the Meyer Memorial Trust or the Collins Foundation. We are in partnership on almost every single major initiative that we're involved in with other philanthropic organizations around Oregon. Once again, recognizing that Oregon isn't a particularly big state and a particularly wealthy state from a philanthropic standpoint. So as we partner together with other philanthropically minded people and organizations, we can get more accomplished as we target those resources. Part of our network also includes professional advisors around the state who are working with their clients, helping them think about what's the right thing for my client who's thinking about some sort of charitable gift and charitable giving, and how can we help leverage that in a meaningful way. We help those individuals and organizations and provide resources and support to them as they're doing their charitable planning and thinking about what they want to do. And our staff support those individual donors and helping them develop their thinking about where they would like their precious charitable resources to target differences and to make differences in their community. And then finally, this network is made up of thousands of generous donors, Oregonians who are, in some cases, giving away large amounts of their resources to make a difference in their community and to see those changes happen that they're searching for. So that's the network that we use, and it's really this network that I think that makes OCF powerful. As a result of that, we work with thousands of nonprofit organizations who are also part of this network, and by working with them, we get to better understand what their needs are and what issues they're trying to serve in community, and we provide that information again back to those who have resources to support those organizations. And so that's really the mission of OCF, is trying to work those relationships and networks in a way that can make change in community. Some of you know that OCF is fortunate, and maybe you've seen some of our research. Over the last 7 years, we've invested in a research department that is helping us really think about our strategic priorities, providing impartial research and analysis to some of Oregon's pressing issues. And one of the pressing issues that we've been working on for the last several years, I want to talk a little bit more about with you. And we call it the opportunity gap in Oregon. But it really is focused on the opportunity gap that exists for children in this state. And by opportunity gap, we mean low-income kids, kids of color, and rural kids who are not receiving the same opportunities in their homes, schools, and communities that are available to other Oregon children, making it more challenge for them, much more of a challenge for them to thrive and flourish and succeed as an adult. We're talking about kids who in every other way would have the opportunity to flourish and succeed, but are essentially limited by the birth lottery of where they were born, their family, or their race. These are kids for whom we believe the American dream is just that for most of them. It's more of a dream than a reality. And what we know about these kids in Oregon is that the gap widens over their lifetime. It has serious implications for the long-term health of the state. It has serious implications for the economic health of the state. And particularly, we see this as vital for rural communities. As all these challenges mount serving this population of children, and the challenges that they will face in adulthood, and the lack of economic mobility out of poverty, the ability to actually support and develop the resources to assist with those challenges just aren't existing in our state's budget. And if you have any doubt about that, you can just be reading the newspaper over the last couple of weeks and seeing the challenges that they're dealing with there. So what we've done at OCF is not only have we tried to raise this issue through research and publishing reports, and trying to engage policymakers and others to think about how we can narrow the opportunity gap, we also recognize that it can't just be about advocacy. It can't just be about policy issues and waiting for either Salem or Washington, D.C. to address the issue. It's essential that this be a community-based effort, because the challenges that are being faced by kids in Ontario are different in kind and type, perhaps, than the kids in Springville. Or in Springfield, or the kids down on the South Coast, where I was yesterday in Coos Bay and North Bend. And the resources in those communities are different as well. So we are working with communities to have them develop community solutions to how they can approach, using the resources they have available with additional support, narrowing the opportunity gap for kids in their communities. It's a surprising thing for some people to learn that 41% of children born in the state of Oregon today are born to single-parent families, and most of that is single moms. And what we know about that is that it's tough for a single mom in an economic condition like the ones we're dealing with, particularly in rural Oregon, and with the cost of housing and other things being as high as they are, to be able to provide the necessary time and support and energy to do the sort of support that those kids actually need. And so we have to rethink how we're delivering services in community to support families and to help families gain the kind of stability they need to be able to be successful as they work with and are raising their children. OCF deploys a number of tools and resources that we believe develops and helps us on this impact that we're trying to have throughout the state. As I mentioned, we do grants, and we make lots of grants to organizations. We also have an Oregon Impact Fund, where we actually loan organizations money when a loan is actually more impactful than a grant, as they're doing some sort of capital raise for an important issue. I've mentioned our research, our advocacy, and our community advice solutions, working with donors, families, businesses, and organizations through their charitable funds to get this work done. We also have taken the lessons that we've learned in some cases over the last 30 years and the research that we've done to focus on some very specific topics, one of which we believe is really important is quality preschool. And so we have done a lot in the last 30 years and are continuing to work on issues around early childhood and early learning as an essential element for the future of this state. Also, the OCF, the Ford Family Foundation, the Meyer Memorial Trust, and the Collins Foundation, over the last 10 years, have been partners in a network to create parenting education hubs all across Oregon. We now have successfully operating hubs serving 32 of Oregon's 36 counties, supporting parenting education organizations that are delivering this service on the ground, helping them use best practices, and strengthening the long-term plan for universal parenting education so that that's as common as childbirth education. I don't know how many of you remember when you went to those classes having a baby. At least for me, they told me everything we needed to know about having the baby. They didn't tell me anything we were supposed to do when we took the baby home. The idea here is to actually integrate parenting education in such a way as to make it universally available for all families to try to help them as we deal with this issue. In addition to these specific actions, we have an early childhood early childhood equity fund. We are continuing to support the creation legislatively of an African American Black Student Success Plan through the legislature, because there are discrete and specific populations in this state that we are failing to serve appropriately, and you can see it in the data with respect to academic advancement. So this includes a Latino Student Success Plan, an African American and Black Student Success Plan, and a Native American Student Success Plan. These three populations are scoring the lowest in academic achievement, and the current models we've been using to try to get to those populations through the education system aren't working. And so these specific dollars that are targeted to those populations to help us improve outcomes is, I think, absolutely essential. For a decade, OCF and our funding partners have also been working on a serious statewide issue around school-based dental health. Many of you might know that Oregon ranks as one of the lowest states in the nation on the quality of our children's teeth. That's for a lot of reasons, one of which I think is our statewide aversion to fluoride. But regardless of your point of view on fluoride, it doesn't make sense to have children in kindergarten and grade school and high school with rotting teeth and mouths and then expect them to actually be able to academically perform. And it has long-term consequences for their future health and their future employment. So we've been in a partnership for the last 5 years with these other organizations trying to strengthen the state's response and the philanthropic response to trying to address the simple issue of kids' dental health. And it seems like it should be simple. We know how to solve this problem, and it's not that complicated. And so trying to bust the bureaucracies that make it difficult for parents with children to have access to appropriate preventative dental care is an issue we care very much about because we understand the long-term consequences. Also, an issue that you may be concerned about, I know everywhere I go in Oregon, this is the number one issue people want to talk to me about, is an issue around homelessness and housing. We recently commissioned a statewide report by Echo Northwest that looked at the entire issue on homelessness and housing from a data standpoint. We published that report in March. If any of you are interested in seeing it, I'd encourage you to get onto the OCF website. If you don't want to read the whole report, I'd encourage you to at least read the executive summary. It provides a lot of, I think, unique and interesting information that should be used as a way to help us start to have important policy conversations about how we're going to address the populations, very distinct populations of homelessness in this state, with housing needs and long-term supports for some of those populations. And that won't come easy and it won't come cheap, but we're not going to get ahead of the problem unless we actually confront the real issue of both the supply side issue of housing and then the lack of wraparound support services for those who are suffering from chronic homelessness. And we can talk about those issues in the Q&A if you'd like to. And then finally, I'll announce that we just entered into a new partnership that is the first in our experience at the Oregon Community Foundation, a statewide partnership. Through a generous grant from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, we are leading something we're calling the Pacific Northwest Resilient Land Initiative. This is a partnership of three community foundations, the Oregon Community Foundation, the Idaho Community Foundation, and the Seattle Foundation, and the National Land Trust Alliance to permanently protect thousands of acres of natural land in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington that can preserve biodiversity, durable wildlife habitat, and functional migration corridors as the climate changes. It's a coordinated effort to actually increase the capacity of the land trust organizations in each of those three states, and is based on a very strong set of science to identify where these very important biodiversity corridors exist in the three states. And we're excited about that work, not only with our own donors who have expressed strong interest in the issues about the impact of climate change, but also to be in partnership with three other community foundations in the region, recognizing that these kinds of issues don't stop at a state's borders. We have to look at the Northwest more as a broader ecosystem and not think about it simply at one state at a time. So we're excited about that issue. I also thought I might mention a couple of things just here locally that OCF has recently been excited to support. We've obviously, many of you may know, been a longtime supporter of Ophelia's Place, and that's actually highlighted. We highlight a story about Ophelia's Place in our brand new annual report that just got released earlier this month. Most of you have a little card on your table. I'd encourage you to take it. On the back is the link to our annual report, and I'd encourage you to, if you want to see more about all the things OCF is up to take a look at our annual report. We've also been supporting, both through OCF and through a number of our donors here in the area, a number of organizations, the Central Latino Americano, Downtown Languages, and Jurado de la Familia, my Spanish is not that great, the impact of sustained investment in these organizations focusing on immigrant families and services to support them and to provide legal support for them in these challenging times. The Oregon Community Foundation has also been a longtime sponsor or a longtime supporter, and recently we made a $500,000 loan to another great organization in your community called Sponsors, Inc., and I'm sure many of you are familiar with Sponsors. I got to know Sponsors directly when I was the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and continue, as I often get called from people all over the country, continually identify Sponsors, Inc. as a national model for reentry and transition services to releasing offenders, and encourage people from around the country to come see Sponsors, Inc. and how they operate. We're excited to be part of a new Pay for Success housing project that they're working on, and are just excited to be part of that. As part of this housing issue as well, we've been involved in First Place Family Center, providing preschool education to homeless children whose families live at St. Vincent de Paul's First Place Family Center. We've made some investments in the Roosevelt Crossing Project and the Tiny Home Project, and in Youth House, where we contributed again, this is a St. Vincent de Paul project, to house girls of ages 16 to 18 who are homeless and enrolled in school. So these are some of the efforts that we're making to address the immediate on-the-ground needs regarding the homelessness and housing situation, and those are absolutely essential. We must continue to support the organizations that are dealing with the immediate effects of those issues. What we know is that's not the long-term solution, and we also have to be working on longer-term solutions. So I'll just end, and I don't know where I'm at on my timing, but I'm good. All right, so I can slow down and talk a little bit more. I will just end with a little bit of a story about an experience that I had just a couple of months ago. I was at a conference, and I had the chance to spend part of the morning with David Brooks, who is the New York Times columnist that I'm sure some of you read. And I was really fascinated to listen to him talk about, from his perspective, the challenges that we're facing as a country, as people are further and further dividing and sort of squaring off into their camps and not communicating with each other and not talking with each other. And the risk that that presents broadly, in his opinion, and frankly in my opinion, to our ability to actually get the important things done. And I appreciated Steve's initial comments about the civil society and the rules of civility that exist here at the City Club, and the need for more of that to exist in our communities more broadly. And so he was talking about this issue, and it was a bit dour, frankly. But then in the middle of that conversation, he turned the corner and he began to talk about it. And if you've read some of his columns recently, you may have seen reference to this. He talked about this project that he's involved in, and it resulted in him traveling around the country and visiting communities all over the country where they are actually successfully addressing some of the challenges, the serious challenges that those communities face. And he looked for the common bond in why certain communities were able to address these issues and others seemed to struggle. And what he identified was a group of people in each of those communities that he refers to as weavers, community weavers, people who are weaving together the solutions in communities in small but meaningful ways that are actually starting to heal and address those local community challenges. And that resonated so much with me as the CEO of OCF, because I truly believe that we are the community foundation, our donors, our volunteers, we are a network of weavers, of people who are looking individually in their community with their resources, with their time, if they have time, with their talents, if they have talents, and with their treasure, if they have treasure, to try to address the issues that are most pressing in their communities. And we are sort of at the center of building this network of community weavers to really problem solve some of the big challenges that are facing Oregon. And it's an important element in any community to have those people who can connect with each other and begin to problem solve. And so we are thinking a lot right now as a statewide organization that is active in places like downtown Eugene and downtown Mitchell, Oregon, to try to find ways to build those kinds of bridges among weavers who see the long-term success, health, and thriving Oregon that we all look for in that process of community engagement and community weaving. It is a challenging thing that we are dealing with in this state, and I never want to sort of, it's easy sometimes from a philanthropy standpoint to sort of swoop in and say, oh, aren't things great, people are donating money and we're giving this great money away, and it sometimes has the risk of undercutting the serious challenges that we're facing as a state and in our community. And yet I am constantly reassured when I hear these young kids playing in this community orchestra, and the support that they must be getting from their community in order to be able to have those opportunities. That is reassuring to me. And if we can look for that best sense of reassurance in our own communities, if we can sort of put our disbelief and to some degree disagreement with other people aside and find those things where we have common values and work towards those common values, we have a chance, I think, a real chance of making Oregon the kind of Oregon that we would like it to be. I want it to be a kind of Oregon where when we talk about our children in this state and when we say our kids, we're not just talking about my biological kids. When we say our kids in a community, what I'm hoping what we're saying is our kids in the broadest sense of the word. That these kids that we heard today are your kids and my kids, and we care about their success, and we care about their opportunity to thrive, and we care about their opportunity for a future. And that is ultimately what we're striving to achieve through the work that we do at the Oregon Community Foundation. So with that, I'll say thank you very much for your time and attention, and after the break, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Max. That was a very enlightening piece of information you gave us there, a lot of it. Thank you. And so now we're going to take a break for about 5 minutes so we can pose our questions and go ahead and make a cue over here. Thanks a lot.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the May 17th, 2019 program, Oregon Community Foundation's effort for the common good. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our sponsors. This week's gold sponsors are Louvis Cobb, Jerry D. Deet Helm, architects, landscape architects, and Dr. Sandy Ibarra, hearing associates. We also are supported by Evans, Elder, and Brown, and Schubert. And special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Dot Dotson's Photography, Pack Info, and Simplified Computing, LLC. We will now move into our questions session, and I'd like to invite Max back to the podium. Please welcome Max.
Thank you.
Williams. Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ruth Daimler, and I'm a volunteer with St. Vinny's, and I just want to thank your organization for support that we've had, especially the teen girls. When they walked into the rooms and saw that they had a room all by themselves, it was just amazing. Their response was so thrilling to watch.
Well, thank you, Ruth. And obviously, you know, we provided some resource, but it's the organization and the volunteers just like you that really make it happen. So thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you. My question today is about the RV parks. I understand when some of the RV parks, especially now in Glenwood, they've decided once an RV park is sold, it has to be emptied. Some of the people have been in those RVs for 30, 40 years. They built them into houses with foundations. And if they're going to be emptied, it means that it's going to be a great change for them. And I can see any moment having thousands of people on the street.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to be paid their full value.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you were working in that direction or knew something was going to happen to make it easier for them.
I appreciate the question. We have actually made loans through our Oregon Impact Fund to a couple of nonprofit organizations that are focused on more specifically manufactured home parks. I don't know quite so much about this specific RV park situation, but I'll just give you a little insight. When I was 17, my Eagle Scout project was actually helping move a woman who was living in what we called a trailer back in those days, because the park she was living in, her trailer was so outdated that they were updating and they wouldn't allow her to stay. So we found a location that she could move her home, and it was, as a 17-year-old, the first time I became aware of what an important, valuable resource for affordable housing, manufactured housing, is in Oregon, and it provides a substantial amount of affordable housing for people. Since that time, there have been some changes legislatively that have actually increased the rights of those homeowners. Before a park sells, they are given a period of time in which they can try to organize and put financing together, and there are organizations who provide this financing, so they can actually buy the park and the underlying ground. And there's a period of time in which they have to do that. Our support was to support the early financing, sort of almost the development financing, for those organizations to be able to try to do that. So we are working generally in the area. I'm not aware specifically of the RV park issue, but if it's a manufactured housing park, we are involved in those kinds of issues. And there are organizations that are working to help the people who live in those parks come together and figure out how they can preserve their housing. So thank you, Ruth, for the question.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm Tom Bauerman. I'm Director of Policy Interactive, one of the sponsors of the City Club. Today I'd like to ask you, if you were a historian living 100 years from now, writing about this time that we live in today, and taking into account that you grew up here in Oregon, and you know Oregon as a young man, and have seen changes,
yeah,
as I have, and you're accumulating that and thinking about the trends, but now you're this historian 100 years from now, stretching the priorities that you've talked about already, but thinking about what those big three issues that we faced in this time, what do you think those are, and what do you think this historian is going to do in terms of rating our ability to deal with this?
I knew if Tom was going to ask me a question, it was going to be a hard one. Let me say that I would say if I was thinking about this, if I could advance myself that 100 years and I look back, I would say that the issues that would be of most concern for me would be the growing economic inequality. That would be on the list of the top three. Again, sort of reflected in this conversation about the opportunity gap, but the growing economic inequality, the differences in the state between those who have access to opportunity and those who don't, that would be one for sure. The second one would be our failure to come together around solutions and to let the kind of division and divisiveness that we're experiencing be a barrier to problem solving. I read something the other day that suggests in research that we are as divided now, we are the most divided in the history of this country right now since the time of the Civil War. That there hasn't been a time since the Civil War statistically with polling that suggests that we've been as divided as we are today. And Tom knows better than anybody that those divisions unfortunately seem to actually be increasing, not decreasing. So this division issue that is keeping us from being able to problem solve together and to miss the opportunity to see our common values. I have decided that I don't talk positions with people about anymore. I start every conversation about values, because when I talk about values, I can get to common ground with people very, very quickly, because I don't know anybody in the state who doesn't care about kids. I don't know anybody in the state who doesn't want actually there to be a strong environment. Those are all things that I think people really want. And if we can talk about things from values, we don't have to get to the position issue. But if I start out with a conversation about positions, we don't move. And so that would be the second issue. Tom, and you're not going to be probably surprised to hear this, because I know it's where you spend so much of your time. Increasingly, I think we are going to be looking at the questions around issues of climate and climate change and its impact, and whether or not, our inability to move quickly enough to ready ourselves for what the ultimate outcome of climate change actually means. Those would probably be the three things on my list.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. I liked what you said about weavers, and are there identifiable weavers working on restoring federal and state money for the rapidly expanding homeless populations of Oregon? I'd like to join them if there's a way to find them. I think the issue of homelessness has to do with the end of welfare, the end of mental health care that's leaving us in devastation and destitution. The weavers have a group of any kind?
I really do think there are, in almost every community I've been to, there are a variety of people who are working on this issue. Whether or not they've solidified around an effort that you could call an organized group, I think is really community dependent. Our effort around publishing the research we published was in part to hopefully further a conversation that wasn't based on the emotional response that we often are seeing in communities relative to the homeless population. I think it's worth pointing out, there are really, and many of you probably know this already, there are really two separate kinds of homeless population. There's the visible homeless population that we see in streets and parks, the chronic homeless. The response to that population is really specialized, and it's not going to be cheap, and it's going to require additional support from government and wraparound services. There's also a homeless population that most of us don't see, the hidden homeless population of people who are living on other people's couches, bouncing in and out of shelters. And one of the pieces of research that came out of this report that was perhaps the most concerning to me is there are 156,000 families in Oregon who are considered to be on the edge of homelessness based on the percentage of their income that they are paying currently for housing. These are people who are just a few hundred dollars away potentially from a you know, a car breakdown or a doctor's bill or something that could potentially move them into homelessness. And what is truly concerning for me is that if we were to enter a recessionary period, a strong recessionary period again, and those people were to basically fall out of their financial situation, we would have a really serious problem. Now, I imagine to some degree rents during that period would start to decline, and there would be some market adjustment that would happen just economically, but probably not quick enough to address this challenge. And so there is all sorts of issues that we need to be thinking about how to stabilize. And the other piece that I'll share, and not everybody likes this because it has a development edge to it, since 2008, we have built for every 10 family units that have come into the state or have been created in the state, we have built 6 units of housing. So we have only provided 60% of the housing needs in this state in construction and development based on the population growth, which means that we're it's a supply and demand thing, and part of the reason we have the kind of rental issues that we're facing in virtually every community in Oregon is driven by some lack of supply, and that is really affecting this 156,000 families that are paying substantially more than they should be if we had built that supply for their rent. And so this is not a one silver bullet solution. There are many, many factors that are going to have policy issues, changes in people's mind, a willingness to walk away from NIMBYism when somebody needs to build something in your neighborhood to support families. A lot of people don't want an apartment building down the street from where they live. But we have got to change our viewpoint if we want to change the outcome. And if we're unwilling to do that, we're going to be living with this problem for a long time.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Shorak-Petty, City Club member. At my table, we decided we needed a few more details. So can you describe how this actually works, how your organization actually works, in terms of where funds come from and how they are distributed, and how does this compare to United Way of Oregon? How is it different from United Way?
From United Way, sure. I'm happy to do that. So our funds generally come from individuals or families who decide that they want to do something charitably, and they are not necessarily just going to do it one time in a gift at the end of the year for a single activity or event. It often happens when they are also doing their long-term planning. So they're developing their wills and their estate plans and the like, and they have organizations or causes or issues that they have supported throughout their lifetime, and they develop a fund at OCF or a plan to have a fund at OCF. Sometimes they fund it still while they're living because there are advantages from a tax standpoint or other things to fund their charitable giving at the sale of a piece of real estate or a sale of a business or a gift of appreciated stock, where it's a smart thing to expand their charitable pool. At other times, it's testamentary. In other words, it funds at the end of a person's life. And so typically, it's the longer-term charitable planning. And that's different than sort of more of the checkbook giving through a United Way sort of process that people would do through their employer with some kind of a match program or something else. So that's the money all comes from individual donors or donor families primarily. We do have corporate funds where corporations also set up their charitable funds with us at times, but that's the primary source. How people access the funds are in a variety of ways, but most nonprofit organizations, we have a wide open twice a year community grant program. So nonprofit organizations apply through a grant, an online grant form, and those grants and requests all come into the organization. We share those grant requests not only with our own set of money to award grants, but we share them with our donors, who also can recommend grants from their donor funds to support nonprofit organizations, and many do. So that's the process, how we become aware. United Way not specifically, doesn't typically apply for a grant, but we have, there are United Ways around the state. They're all not one United Way. I'm more familiar with the United Way of the Columbia Willamette in Portland, and we've both partnered and supported with various research projects and work the United Way is doing. But we're sort of different than United Way from a working with donors standpoint. They are more kind of working with that employment relationship and with companies who are sort of using their giving method And that's not the model that we use. But we partner with United Way around the state on a variety of different things.
Sandy Erickson, my question requires a little bit of run up here, so I think we have time. But anyway, I see in doing what I'm doing with the homeless issue that there's very little prevention that is planned for and executed. There's a lot of treating the symptoms, especially the ones that are public. But for instance, in the schools, there's hardly anything taught on life skills. And I looked up all the deep background on Oregon's educational plans and so on. It gets a paragraph about this long.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is, but clearly you can't produce people who can produce unless you can make them whole within their own four walls. And so I'm wondering if you know why this is. I mean, it used to be people learned about food and nutrition, so they didn't have big medical bills, housing, financial management. There's a whole list of about five different things, including parenting, all of which, if it starts to slip, could eventually lead to homelessness and certainly is a factor in every one of those 156,000 families.
Yeah.
So if this is such a glaring problem and the solution is so obvious, why is it systematically avoided?
I appreciate the question, and I have often thought back in my 11th year in high school, attending a class which I think we called personal finance, but it was a class that actually required us to understand how a credit card works and how a checkbook works and how insurance works and all of those things. And then it also included a unit on family development where we were assigned to one other person in the class and had to take care of the proverbial egg for the 3 or 4 days, if any of you remember that experience in school. And so I don't see those classes necessarily. I think our focus on, and I mean our collective focus on more core education or STEM and some of those things have driven out the opportunity for those more practical skills classes. But that was at a time also when you could take wood shop and metal shop and even what in those days were referred to probably unfairly as home ec classes that also had certain life skill components to it. What we do know is there are a number of nonprofits around the state and other partners, and I'll just give you an example. Most of the credit unions, for example, I know are sponsoring these kinds of classes to work with students and in some cases in schools to provide this kind of education because it's not necessarily being provided by the system with all the threats and challenges that they're facing. So I think it's a great question. I personally think it's something that everybody should have. I mean, it is ultimately teaching about how to be self-sustaining and self-supported, and those are important things.
Well, it relates to the gender differences. Those are usually classes and areas that happen in the home that are driven by women, and it's part of the devaluation of women.
Yeah.
In a sense. And well, it's unfortunate, but it's costing the state and the country a tremendous amount.
I appreciate your comments very much.
So we got one more question. Yeah, let me get it in there.
This is given to me by my group, and this contains a short statement. I'm going to read what it says to you, but I have a paraphrase question of my own which might explain better what I think this means to us. So anyway, first I want to thank you and for the OCF and donors and mostly the volunteers who perform this caring work in our communities funded by OCF. However, many of these problems are caused by the war against working families, by the billionaires, whose philanthropy can in no way make up for a burdened system. A system of obscene and inequalities and a lack of basic fairness. our institutions are increasingly support a system of indentured servitude. Our universities are debt machines. Our profit or for-profit care system makes money off of denying care. And the next question is, well, what can OCF do to address these basic causes of poverty, disease, and homelessness? Now, I'm seeing this as understanding as, is there some kind of reverse communication where you can speak to the people who take, you know, made huge profits and huge monies off of these attacks on the working families, to just simply stop it at the source, stop taking, stop exploiting. But I don't know that. Can you talk about that?
Well,
communication
I can try.
Both ways.
Am I stopping too, or is he stopping? Okay. All right. Well, what I would say, I mean, and I appreciate the spirit of the comment and the issue. Clearly, this is issues of economic inequality that I referenced, and we're working on a number of fronts to do that. I'm really hesitant generally to be critical of any person, regardless of their economic wealth, who has made a decision to give their money away to good causes. If we want to be critical of wealthy people and millionaires and billionaires, let's be critical of the ones who actually aren't doing any philanthropy at all. And there are plenty of them who are, buying, new houses, new jets, new whatever, and aren't giving anything back to community. I'm pretty willing to defend the people that I know, the generous Oregonians that I know, who are giving back. And not all of them are billionaire fat cats. The average size of a fund at the Oregon Community Foundation is about $230,000. They are retired school teachers and bus drivers, people who worked in a community their whole lives and have put a little money aside and are now generously wanting to give it back to community. That's the bread and butter of the Oregon Community Foundation. These are people who are your friends and your neighbors and the people you know in community who are giving their money they could be spending on a lot of other things, including giving it to their kids, and they're not. They're giving it back to community. So I'll go down swinging in defense of people who are giving their money away, because there are so many people in this country who are not trying to give anything back to make things better. So when we're done picking on those people, then you can decide to pick on the philanthropists. Thanks.
Thank you, Max. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Some great questions today. This is great work, serious work, and I appreciate the breadth of the work that the OCF is doing and addressing, so thank you. Before we thank our speaker today as a group, I'd like to have a few announcements. I'd like to thank public station, radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing the City Club programs on Mondays at 6:30 p.m. And thank you to the Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29 for televising recent City Club programs. Next week, we will have the monthly Community Spotlight, which takes place at Tsunami Bookstores Wednesday night, 6 p.m. I personally will be interviewing Jason Yonkers, who is from the University of Oregon and is a native sovereign liaison for the University of Oregon. And so that should be a great program. It's a program that the City Club hopes to support and get more people to come out and just see some of the great work that's happening in our community. We will not be having a Friday forum on next week due to the observance of Memorial Day. So we hope to see you all out in the community on Memorial Day. There will be a community potluck and barbecue held at 22nd and Washington Street on Memorial Day. The whole community's welcome to come there, and I know the City Club will be there with the table and talking about the great work we do. So for more details and information about future programs, you can find that information on our website at cityclubofeugene.org. So now, without any further ado, let's thank our speaker, Max Williams. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate all the good work. And this concludes today's program.